Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.FM, here in Portland, Oregon. My name is Cecil Prescott, and we are glad that you are joining us on this day, Monday, July 25th, 2011. Finally, summer arrived in Portland this past weekend. Many people were able to enjoy the weather, and many people were able to enjoy the outdoors and to go from place to place. Recently, a national magazine rated public transportation in Portland as the number one public transportation city in the United States. Now, those who are familiar with our system of buses and light rail and bikes are often proud of our little city here and the way we do things. But there are also some concerns about TriMet and how we raise funds and whether or not all people are adequately served. Certainly the issue of transportation is a phenomenon not limited to Portland, but it is a concern of people throughout the world. Joining us this morning in a conversation about public transport is Dave Wetzel, who has worked on these issues for many years. He joins us from England, and we invited him to participate in our conversation to talk about transportation issues and about whether or not there are alternative ways of financing transportation and ways in which we can promote better use of public transportation. We thank you, Dave, for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me. I ought to make it clear I'm not here to tell anybody what to do. All I can do is share some of my experiences, and if it's of any use to your listeners, then I'm very happy.
Well, great. Perhaps we should begin by allowing you to introduce yourself. Why are you here in the States this time? And tell us a little bit about your background.
I was invited to speak at a conference in Milwaukee and decided to use the opportunity to see more of your beautiful country. So kicked off for 2 weeks as a pure tourist and went to Vegas and Hollywood and around Arizona looking at the sights. And then went to San Francisco, which was my first event. And now I've got events planned for Chicago, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, going up to Toronto for a meeting. And also then going all the way down to Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and then flying home on the 18th of August out of New York. And each of those cities I'll be meeting people and doing events.
Great. Well, it sounds like quite an extensive tour, and you see quite a variety of cities and urban areas in on this continent, certainly. Tell us a little bit about your initial involvement in terms of your home, about what motivated you. We were able to chat a little bit before coming on air on the radio, and you shared something about your background with the Labor Party and some of the ways in which you grew and developed and challenged some of the powers and authorities.
Well, I was brought up in a transport family. My father was a bus conductor all his working life. And I myself became a bus conductor at the age of 19. But I was interested in trade union and socialist affairs. I was a member, joined the Labour Party, and became a councillor when I was 21 in the local authority. And some years later, having been a shop steward at Heathrow Airport and a political organiser for the London Co-op, I was elected to the Greater London Council. And to my surprise, my colleagues chose me to be the chair of the Transport committee, which was a dream job for me. London at that time, population 6 million people in 1981. Our transport committee was spending a budget of £2 billion a year. Mm-hmm. It appointed the board of London Transport and controlled the major capital budget spending and revenue spending of London Transport, and that was the buses and the undergrounds. And we built the Docklands Light Railway, introduced paratransit for people with disabilities. But our most significant policy at that time was cutting the fares. You should never trust a politician. We promised to cut the fares by 25%, but in the event we cut them by 32%, and introduced a zonal system, which was, we considered, much more efficient. But not everybody benefited, and particularly in South London, where they didn't have any underground trains, they were paying the higher property tax to fund this, but not getting all the benefits. They got cheaper fares on their buses, but Mrs. Thatcher, the Prime Minister at the time, wouldn't let the mainline railway come into the system. So They took us to court, and after three court cases, eventually in the House of Lords, on December the 17th, 1981, a date I'll never forget, the House of Lords ruled against us. And our solicitors, lawyers, interpreted that ruling that we had to do everything to make London Transport profitable, including increasing the fares until they reached the point of diminishing returns. Mm. That, in the short term, meant a doubling of fares, which I and my leader, Ken Livingstone, voted against, but the majority voted for. And so together with others, I organised a Can't Pay, Won't Pay campaign, where we gave our names and addresses on alternative tickets and said we're not paying the higher fare. I got taken to court together with Heather, my wife, and we, in running the campaign, described the law lords as vandals in ermine because they did more to vandalise the transport system in London than any young kids ever could out on the streets. And in court, the magistrate accused me of behaving like an animal in the way that I gesticulated and things. So when I next appeared in court, I took a monkey with me, a dummy model, with my hand up his bottom and wiggling his eyes. And the judge wasn't too happy about that, but it did give us plenty of press publicity. We got fined. I was a bit annoyed because Heather got fined more than me. But we went on to do greater things afterwards. A year later, in 1983, we introduced cheaper fares again. But this time, we won a legal challenge, and it was considered legal. And we introduced the travel card to London, which is like the carte orange, where you can use a daily, weekly, monthly, annual pass on all parts of the system. So it encourages people, once they've bought the pass, to make good use of it. We also introduced extra facilities for bus priority, cycling, and indeed for pedestrians, because we think pedestrians are neglected.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and this is your community radio station at 90.7. FM in the metro area, 91.9 if you're in the Gorge, and 100.7 in the Willamette River Valley.
And we're speaking this morning with Dave Wetzel, who has certainly an extensive background in transportation issues. He's visiting this country on an extensive tour, speaking with communities about public transportation, and I hope, I assume you're getting some sense of the transportation systems in different municipalities.
Oh, absolutely, and I've always wanted to come to Portland. Portland is internationally famous for its transport, and like London, not everything's perfect, and more needs to be done, I suppose, in terms of the suburbs and bus transit. But what we've seen on our television and heard about at conferences, what Portland achieves, is tremendous. And there's lessons for all of us from what you're doing here in your city.
One issue that comes up, and you mentioned in terms of your campaign, can't pay, won't pay campaign, constantly in terms of as the Portland transportation try to balance the needs of riders with the needs to finance. One thing that continues periodically is in terms of fare increases and how to balance between those who use the public transportation system, how much should they pay, as opposed to businesses who benefit from it. Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of that juggling that society takes?
Very much so. One of the things we noticed when we built the Docklands Light Railway, it increased land values around the stations particularly. And this is true of transportation and society and the community generally. We improved our bus services in London. We gained 50% in ridership over an 8-year period when I was working for the Mayor of London from 2000 to 2008. And the people who benefit when you improve transport are, first of all, the travellers. They have an opportunity. Second beneficiary is, as you say, businesses. They have a wider catchment area for employing staff. They have more customers finding their way to their premises more easily. So businesses benefit. But there is a third beneficiary that nobody ever talks about, and that is landowners. If transport in a city is improved, then people want to live there, people want to work there, people want to run businesses there. The first thing they need is a location. And as things improve, the landowners will increase the price of that location. Now, that is an unearned income. They do nothing to create land values. And what I argue is that we should all share in that increase in land value. And an easy way to do it is to introduce an annual land value tax where land is valued for its optimum permitted use, and every year a tax is paid on the land value only. And I would take it to the extent that I would abolish taxes on wages, abolish taxes on profits, abolish sales taxes, and replace them. Oh, and of course, abolish property taxes on buildings. Why should you pay more because you improve your building? That is a nonsense. But for the location, it's a benefit that landowners receive from others, and it is only right and proper that they should repay others by picking up the tax bill.
And
well, one of the things I think is really fascinating is that here in Portland, you know, wage earners and business owners do pay a tax for TriMet. When I worked as an independent contractor, I also paid TriMet tax, and I lived in East Portland at the time. So in one sense, that is something that everyone who works already pays. I'm curious as to how property owners who live closer to key TriMet locations or bus terminals, how a tax on them would offset the tax that everyone who works and lives in the metro area pays. It seems as though that may not be significant, a significant replacement.
Well, way economics works is that if you create wealth, you employ labor, you employ capital, and you need land. The person who provides the labor gets paid wages, and by labor I'm including mental work as well as physical hard work. the person who saves and provides capital gets a profit or interest. But the person who provides land, and you can't produce anything without land, it isn't just about growing on the fields, it's also about having a site for your office block downtown. The person who provides the land is providing something which would be there with or without them. The land was there before mankind walked on this planet, and therefore it's only right and proper that the return for land, instead of going to an individual, should come to the whole community. And it has very great benefits in terms of land gets wasted because of speculation. Just going around your city, I've seen empty sites, I've seen empty homes, boarded up homes indeed. And that is a nonsense. When people need homes, because I've also seen homeless people, we need to put those sites to work. And one way to put them to work is to say to the owners of that land and all land, you're going to pay every year to the government or to the local community through their elected council. And then, having made that payment, they will want to put the land to use. They won't speculate and keep it out of use and make a profit that way. They will use it to make a profit. That creates jobs, it creates wealth, it creates a happier community. In Harrisburg, Harrisburg currently has some problems. They borrowed too much money for various reasons, one of their agencies. But back in the 1970s, they introduced a very small land value tax. And the mayor elected in 1982, Stephen Reed Jr., he increased the millage rate on the land and reduced the millage rate on the buildings. And as a result, unemployment fell by 19%. Growth of business was startling. They had about 2,000 businesses paying taxes locally. They've now got over 9,000 businesses paying taxes locally. It's only a small city, even though it is the capital of Pennsylvania. And building permits were applied for. They've gone up dramatically. Downtown car lots are no longer car lots. They're now pavement cafes with apartments or offices above. And the donut effect of the middle class moving out of the city centre into the suburbs has been reversed, and people are now moving back into Harrisburg. One of the things that the mayor talks about is crime, and he says that people who tend to commit crime, not everybody obviously, but they tend to have little money in their pockets, plenty of free time on their hands, and they live in rundown areas where there's no civic pride. His land value tax created jobs, which put some money in some people's pockets. It robbed them of their free time. They came home from work. They were too tired to go out and rob their neighbours. They sank in front of the television. And the areas they lived in, the landowners improved the buildings, smartened up the districts, and brought back a civic pride. His crime fell by 52%. That was a dramatic effect. He also had fewer fires because a lot of fires start in empty buildings. So there's all sorts of knock-on effects. And that was with a very small land value tax. What I'm suggesting is that all of land value should go to the community.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking this morning with Dave Wetzel. And if you use public transportation or if you have a suggestion on how to improve public transportation in your area, give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. Again, our numbers are 503-231-8187.
That's it. Well, I can appreciate how we have a trickle-down effect, but given the fact still, I'm still curious because for TriMet, payroll taxes and other taxes comprise about 49%. That's a pretty high percentage. And right now, businesses that are in the transit district already pay. So what it sounds as though is that they would increase their tax burden. And the way Oregon and especially Portlanders cry about tax burden because of the way we have managed without a sales tax, it seems as though it's something that the average person would not be supportive of, because those who have property in the transit areas, especially homes as opposed to business property, would still feel a bigger tax bite. We just recently had a two-tiered property tax proposition go down, part of it go down because most of the property owners who were paying for the school bonds felt as though one was not the best use of their money, one was a bite the bullet and accept it. And so it doesn't seem as though it would be popular in the minds of people, even hearing some of the benefits that you've mentioned.
People need to think for themselves.
Well, they're thinking for themselves. They're thinking with their pocketbook, you know, as well as their hearts. That's the main reason why the part of the school bond that supported, increases for salaries and a few other items did pass. But the ones for buildings to be improved, some of which lie in the transit zone, that failed miserably. Now, there was lots of reasons why, but, I mean, we're still talking about a municipal area that is very shy of increased taxes because of the way our tax burden has been allocated.
I'm suggesting is not an increase in taxation. It's a change in taxation, which has fundamental effects on the economy. The reason for the change is to create a fairer system than we already have, a more just system than we already have, and to alter the tax burden so that we take taxes away from production. Let's produce wealth. Let's encourage the production of wealth. Don't let's discourage it with taxes on wages and taxes on buildings. If you put the tax on site value, site value tax gets paid, but at the moment we pay it to private individuals called landowners. In my country, to people like the Duke of Westminster. Here, I suppose you pay it to people like Trump. But if you're going to pay it anyway, why pay it to landowners? Far better to pay it to the community instead of taxes that you currently pay. Reduce the taxes you currently pay and replace it with a tax on land values. It can be done gradually. That proposition sounds a good way forward to actually split the property tax into two parts. It also broadens the base because landowners with no buildings will then pay the land value tax. And the people that benefit from community activity are people living in the community, but the hidden beneficiaries are the landowners who charge higher rents because the city is a beautiful city, good transport and all the rest of it. So the idea of a land value tax is that the high rents that you already pay to a landowner for the location goes to the community.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. And Joe is calling. Good morning, Joe. Do you use public transportation?
Occasionally, but I just wanted to let you know that I just got a letter from the Portland General Electric Company, which provides my utilities, saying that the city of Lake Oswego, in which I reside, has imposed a 1.5% tax on their use of public right-of-ways for their utility poles and infrastructure, and that they're passing that tax on to their customers in the form of a charge based on their energy consumption. So the more electricity I use, the more tax I pay to PGE, which is then, I guess, according to the letter, paying the Lake Oswego right-of-way tax. Now, I heard nothing about the tax from the city, and this is a letter from PGE that came about 2 weeks ago. So I just thought, you know, this is kind of interesting. I'm not sure what exactly the city intends to do with the tax money, but I haven't heard about it from anybody else other than this letter from PGE. I just wanted to pass that on. You can comment as you like or whatever. I'll take my comments off the air. Anyway.
Thank you, Joe.
Some new way for them to generate more income. So, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
this is an example of what happens when you don't have a system like land value taxation. You have to tax production. And it sounds to me what Joe has said, that PG are introducing or having to pay a tax now on their wiring, on their poles. That, to my mind, is a nonsense. Do we want electricity to go into neighbourhoods? Yes, we do. By taxing it, you're trying to stop that happening. Do we want idle land? Do we want empty homes? No, we don't. And if you tax the land, it will bring it into use. It will bring the empty homes into use. It solves so many other problems if you tax land values and take taxes off of production.
Well, in this case, if I understand Joe correctly, the big issue for him is that you've got a large utility that is passing a tax that is rightfully theirs onto the consumer, and then on top of that, it's a tax that they need to pay. They don't pay much in taxes anyway in the state. I believe at one time, was it PGE that we were touting the $30 business income tax bill? Right, right. So the issue is that this is an unfair tax being passed on to the consumer instead of the company absorbing it as it should.
Our number is here, 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Dave Wetzel. We invite your call or comments. If you use public transportation, if you have questions or concerns about how it is used, how it is paid for, give us a call. We welcome your comment.
We'd like to hear from people who have business property within the district that would be taxed as well, or homeowners. 503-231-8187.
Now, your proposal of this land value tax certainly has gotten some pushback, some opposition from people, I assume. What type of arguments do you hear against this proposal? And what are the best arguments, you know, besides, I don't want to pay?
I think before people understand exactly the full implications, somebody who's a homeowner, for example, thinks, oh, well, I own the land on which my house sits, and that will mean that I'll pay an extra bill, the sort of argument Celeste was suggesting. Somebody running a business thinks, well, I've got a business, it's downtown, it's on valuable land, I'm going to have to pay more. If the person rents their home or rents their business site, then they're not going to be paying any more because it is the landowner that the burden falls on. But the best argument I can put is examples. And one example is our Jubilee line in London. We extended the Jubilee line, and it cost about $5 and $6 billion, £3.5 billion. The land value around the 11 new stations went up by £13 billion, which is about $19-20 billion. And that was an unearned income to those landowners, many of whom obviously are located abroad. They don't all live and work in London. So it was an unearned income. And had we collected that, it would have paid for the next railway that we wanted to build, or it would have reduced people's taxes that they currently pay. And it seems to me only right and just that we should be doing that. If you take an example of two householders with identical circumstances, one owning their accommodation, the other one renting it, the owner got a capital sum increase in their land value. The one renting got an increase in the rent that they had to pay because they were close to one of our Jubilee Line stations. So it's an argument about justice, fairness, how best we use the world's natural resources, because it isn't just land. It's talking about oil, mineral resources, landing slots at airports, using the spectrum that this radio station uses to put out its messages.
You are listening to More Talk Radio. Before we take our next caller, let me remind you that coming up at 9 is the Old Mo Variety Hour. At 10 is the Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Local Focus looks at the Soul West Fair that takes place every summer in John Day, Oregon. At 11 on Sounds of Awareness, guest Gail Miller and host Paul Van Dyke discuss the world of Columbia Springs, an environmental education center in Vancouver, Washington. And we want to thank KBOO members for your support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar. Right now, we're speaking with Dave Wetzel. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And let's go to Christine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. Hi, Dave. Hi, Cecil.
Hi, Christine.
I've been trying to really wrap my head around the land value tax idea, and I think it's pretty exciting and would be a wonderful solution in many ways. But my question is that so much commercial activity, so much capital transferring right now occurs virtually, or it occurs in the financial markets. It occurs places that aren't so much based on land-based activity, real estate. So when you're talking about making a shift away from the traditional ways we've tried to capture taxes on capital activity, how do you do that when you've got so much derivative trading and online internet activity now? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Christine. Uh-huh. It's a good question. There's many people have been advocating transactional taxes on financial industry. But let's think about it in its reality. What does the financial industry do? What they do is provide finance for production. They're not actually producing. They're not actually making things themselves. Real world, the real productive wealth that gets made by farmers, workers in factories, transport workers, etc. That is real tangible wealth. What the finance industry does by advancing loans, by providing insurance, helping governments sometimes with their deficits, what they're actually doing is shifting the real wealth away from the people who are producing it and taking a turn themselves. Do we actually need to borrow money in order to create things? That is the first question I ask. If you're creating wealth, then the excess wealth of what we create can either go to the finance industry or it can be used for providing for ourselves at this time. But of course, if you're going to build something which is going to last for 60 years, you don't want to pay for it in one generation. And an obvious way is to use people's savings. And by using people's savings, you can spread the cost of that over several generations. Future generations are going to pay for the swimming pool you're building today, which is going to last for 60 years. The amount of money that gets paid for that borrowing is normally determined by a market, but that market can be distorted by the people who have acquired great amount of wealth through the land system. And that includes the banks as well as individuals with huge amounts of wealth. If you look at where millionaires and billionaires have created or obtained their wealth from, it isn't through hard work in terms of rolling up their sleeves and earning good wages, but it is through managing to capture what Mother Nature has provided. And one way of looking at this is to look at emerging economies like China. I was in China earlier this month. I left on the 1st of July. The Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, Russia. Most of the millionaires and billionaires that have been generated in the last 10, 20 years in those two countries are not people that have come up with a brilliant idea, a brilliant new product that everybody wants to buy. what they've done, they've captured the oil wealth, they've captured the land wealth, they've captured the mineral resources for themselves. And then they sell it to the rest of us at a high price. And that's how they become billionaires. And then their money goes into the financial system that you've been describing, and you say, oh, well, we want to try and tax them on the movement of that money. Well, I'm going back to the source of that money. Let's tax the wealth where it is being created. We live on a planet with all the computers and all the internet and everything else, without actual locations, without a planet on which mankind lives, none of that would take place. And so it's getting back to the basics of economics. And unfortunately, in our colleges and schools, the basic of economics isn't taught. We are taught in our economic classes that there's capital and that there's labor, that they're in conflict with each other, and the whole of the land question and economic rent of land is ignored. The beauty of actually shifting taxes onto the rent of land is that it encourages production. It reduces unemployment. You know, when you look at Aboriginal tribal communities, unemployment doesn't exist, except for somebody who may be injured and is unable to work. But people have plenty of work to do. There's plenty of things they need, and they provide it in a very crude way. Now, we could do the same. There's no reason. There's nothing about nature that unemployment should exist. And if you actually create work for people, then your tax bill goes down because you're spending less on benefits for people who are homeless, less on benefits for people who have young children and can't afford to look after them.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. We're here with Dave Wetzel. And you are invited to join the conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. We're talking about new ideas for funding mass transit, public transportation. If you use public transportation, please give us a call. If you have property in the areas and are curious as to how you would be affected, give us a call. Good morning, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, I want to say that I'm a big fan of mass transit, but I've always regarded TriMet as being ill-visioned and poorly managed. And I wish I could comment on the grand funding of all this, but I want to tell you what annoys the heck out of me every time I get on MAX, and that is that I never know where I am, because TriMet doesn't bother to put a map, basically, up on the wall so that I can see it while I'm riding along. They have a little one, a kind of postage stamp size one at the end of a car if I want to go down there.
They have a big one on the wall. I ride the MAX and I put my bike on it. There's two or three big ones on the wall.
Well, what I get when I go to London and I get in the underground on London is wherever I'm sitting, I just glance up and I can see the whole route up there. And it makes it much easier. I don't have any trouble getting around in London, but I sure do in Portland. And I just think, and what they do like to put up over the windows on the wall is a lot of moralistic slogans and stuff like that, which I regard as total foo-foo, and they need to put real useful information up there. That's all. Thank you.
Hi, Tom. Before the Olympic Games in China, in Beijing, I was invited to go to Beijing to talk about the transport system and maybe some of the changes they should be making. And I said exactly what you've just said. The most important thing that they could do would be to provide better information. Mm-hmm. And if you want people to use a system, they've got to know about it, and it's got to be easy. What we did during the previous 8 years when I was working as vice chair of Transport for London was on all our buses to introduce a system whereby you got both a verbal and a visual indication of, one, the route that you're on, two, the destination of that bus, where it's going to finally get to, and three, the name of the next stop. And that is so useful. The only problem is it's only in English, and if you're a foreign tourist who doesn't speak English, then it's not much help to you. One of the reasons why I support Esperanto, if every kid in the world was taught Esperanto, then we'd all be talking to each other in a simple language when we travel abroad. But your concept of maps is absolutely ideal. That's exactly the sort of thing that we've been trying to do in London. We haven't got it perfect, and we're now bringing it onto the street so pedestrians can have that same facility. You don't have to sit on a bus or sit in a train to see the maps. Yeah, we actually put stuff on the streets of London as well for pedestrians. It's very new and sparse at the moment, but it's the right way forward. We want people to walk, and so to encourage walking, let's give the information on the street corner.
One thing that I think I know that has occurred in over the last few years, 20 years ago, there was passed the American for Disability Act here in the United States, which means that we need to make all things accessible. And so I know on public transportation that the stops are verbally as well as
the electronically. Yeah, LED signs.
So there are steps in that direction, but I'm sure we have a long way to go.
Yeah, and then on the light rail lines, we also have verbal notice in English and Spanish.
Excellent.
Yeah, and as well as the maps that, unfortunately, I don't know where Tom is looking, but they are there.
But certainly America led the way on the question of disability and transport, and in London we've been trying to catch up.
All right. We do have another caller online. Thanks for holding. Good morning, Claudia.
Well, good morning to you, and thank you for this show. As a regular MAX and bus rider, I noticed two things in the last month that seemed to me to epitomize the kind of communication we're getting from TriMax. The first example occurs during or up in the OHSU construction zone up on Markham Hill.
Oh, yeah, Portland Folly.
The drivers have been told to not stop at the stop beside the School of Dentistry. But when you call TriMax, TriMax tells you, you know, their trip planning assistants, they tell people that it's open. So, you know, I learned that you have to go walk down to Casey and then take the scenic route around OHSU. But every time we go down past that bus stop by the School of Dentistry, there are people going, hey, hey, hey. Okay, the other thing is I was out on, what, Holgate and some big number, 92nd or whatever, and I punched in, you know, I called the TriMet number just to see when the next bus was coming, and I punched in, you know, the stop number, and I got information for a stop clear on the other side of town. I thought I made an error, so I called and I punched in the stop number again and looked at it, same one, got the same information about the other part of town, what was happening there. So it sure would be nice if TriMet would work on coordinating communication between its drivers and the people it supposedly serves. So that's all I had to say. Thanks for the program.
All right.
Thank you. And I hope Claudia, that you made your concerns to TriMet.
Yes, please. You know, I've used that number, too, on occasion, and it's really weird. I hope they've improved it because you had to scroll through so many sometimes if you're trying to find out what stop the bus is going to stop at. And so there could be some improvements on it, but the TriMet number is handy.
Yeah. And we're speaking this morning with Dave Wetzel, who for 8 years you served as, oh, I just had it.
Vice Chair of
Transport for London. And you are a transportation expert, among other things, and you've been, you are touring this country, and you've mentioned other countries you have toured. From your observation with the United States has this fascination with automobiles, and the move from automobiles to other means of transportation has been very hasn't been an easy one. There's lots of resistance in terms of building and establishing public transportations. Any observations you've seen, differences between Americans and Europeans' attitude towards transportation?
Huge differences, but it sort of begins really with town planning. And densities of cities and urban sprawl. One of the reasons we promote the idea of land value tax is that it will lead to less urban sprawl and denser cities. And that protects the countryside, and it also makes the city work much more efficiently and economically. If there's more people living in an area, there's more people for the theater, there's more people for the restaurant, there's a larger number of people to recruit from if you're running a business. And so it becomes self-fulfilling. It's like a spiral. Dense cities work. The reason we live in cities at all is because we're more efficient living in cities. And cities only started about 10,000 years ago. It seems a long time, but in terms of 4.5 billion years of this planet, it's quite a recent event. But cities work. They become much more efficient. What we did in London in 2003 was to introduce a congestion charge on cars coming into the central area. Mm-hmm. Now, London is not like Portland. I don't know what the numbers are for Portland, but in London, 90% of commuters were coming in by public transport anyway. Mm. But nevertheless, we had a all-day-long traffic jam in central London. And everybody agreed that in 2000, when the election for mayor for the first time took place, everybody agreed that it needed to be resolved, it needed to be tackled. There were differences about how to do it, but my mayoral candidate, Ken Livingstone, who's a left-wing socialist, he put forward the idea of congestion charging, which is quite a right-wing idea. You pay for some benefit that you're getting. And we introduced it in 1983. He chaired Transport for London, and the first thing he said to me on my appointment as vice chair was, I must have this in within 2 years. Well, we did it in just under three. And motorists today pay $15 to drive their car downtown into the central zone. And even with the change of mayor, a Conservative mayor got elected in 2008. He has kept the central zone congestion charging. So it's now an all-party, generally accepted. I met a plumber who says, I welcome your congestion charge. I pay it every day. But now I can do 5 plumbing jobs in a day, whereas before, when the traffic was bad, I could only do 3 jobs a day. So it actually helps business. It's helping the traffic flow. But more importantly, it's providing an income of over $100 million a year, which goes back into walking, cycling, and buses.
And we have one call, one other caller, Marion. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a little bit confused. I think a lot of people may be a little bit confused about this because how would this change people's tax bill? I don't think people are clear about that. I mean, already as it is, land is worth more than buildings, and when your property tax is assessed, it's based on the combination, but it's actually tends to be more on the land than on the buildings. Also, excuse me, I think you have kind of a tremendous resistance in this country to, there's such a sense of entitlement in the United States of, I'm entitled to own land, I'm entitled to, private property. So I think you're fighting that maybe more than you would in other countries. So if you could speak to that.
Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you.
People are entitled to private property. Certainly the property that we create, I think, should be untaxed. If I work and make a few bucks, why should the taxman take that? If I work longer hours and make a few more bucks, why does that entitle the taxman to any more? Surely the person who works is entitled to keep their wages. The person who comes up with a good idea and makes a profit from manufacturing something, they're entitled to keep the profit. The thing that I argue we're not entitled to is the wealth that's created by everybody else, and that is land wealth. But, of course, the person who sows the seeds in a farmer's field, they want to be the ones that reap the benefit. They don't want somebody else to come along 6 months later and reap the harvest. So there needs to be an entitlement that you can hold property, call it land ownership, whatever. But in return for that, you pay back to the community a benefit you receive. So if my land that I'm farming is on very, very fertile land and I don't have to work too hard, then I should pay more for that. If I was renting that farm, the landowner would charge me more. So a land tax works equitably. It works on a fair basis. If I've got a building, a marvelous, lovely house, and it's in downtown, it'll be worth a fortune. If it's up in Alaska, miles from anywhere, then it'll be worth very little. That difference is a location value that everybody else creates, not the individual landowner. So, yes, you're right, Marion. People do want entitlement. They do want to hold their land, and that's right, and they should be able to. But in doing that, they have an obligation, and the obligation is to everybody else. If I work, I've got no obligation to anybody else. I'm working. It's my effort that goes into it. If I manufacture a product that I've invented, I've got no obligation to anybody else. I've done that. But land is a free gift of nature. It was there before we came onto this planet. And we have an obligation that if we want to have secure tenure, and that's what we're talking about, then we refund other people who cannot have that secure tenure on our piece of land. And the beauty of it is, and it was an American economist, Henry George, in San Francisco, wrote a book called Progress and Poverty. Mm. And he was looking at booms and slumps. And here we are, we're still suffering booms and slumps. President Obama is spending all his time, I hear, he's cancelled meetings today because he's dealing with booms and slumps. And Henry George, back in 1879, wrote this book in San Francisco, and he said, here's how you avoid booms and slumps. Let's tax land values. And he was right.
Yeah, I think I've just... People may be confused about how this changes your typical tax bill for, like, a homeowner.
Well, if you add up all the taxes that you currently pay, and a lot of them are hidden taxes, you might buy food at the supermarket. The taxes in that packet of cornflakes include the taxes paid by the lorry driver that delivered it to the supermarket. It's not just the sales tax that hits you at that moment in time. But if you add up all the taxes that you're paying on the things that you buy and the taxes on the wages that you earn and say, well, let's replace that with a land value tax, you'd be quids in for several reasons. And one reason is it a bigger, wider tax base. And secondly, the people with the best and most expensive land would pay the most. Those of us with a small, modest house would pay the least. And as people got jobs and became into employment, tax expenditure on welfare would be reduced. So the government would need less taxes.
Thank you, Marion. We're at the end of our hour. I'm sure this discussion can continue and will continue. Thank you for your call, and we want to thank Dave Wetzel for joining us this morning for speaking. Is there a website or something somewhere people could
is www.laborland.org.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Thank you for your work.
And coming up at 9 o'clock, the Old Mole Variety Hour, followed by Air Cascady at 10 o'clock, 10:15, Locus Focus, and at 11 a.m., Sounds of Awareness. All of this and more on Your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our engineer, Steve.